listeners, welcome to the Book Report. This is your host, Elaine Charles, and this week we're turning back the clock to see what new gems we uncover in one of my favorite genres, the historical novel. We'll skip from 500 years ago to just last year and preview fascinating new treatments of the familiar. And we've got some amazing nonfiction titles that put a whole new spin on events we thought we knew. Let's get started as we turn to page one of the book report. Come to Miami for the warm winter weather and for the 29th Miami Book Fair International, where Tom Wolfe, Juno Diaz, Lemony Snicket, Sandra Cisneros, and more than 300 authors from around the world will read from their books, answer questions, and autograph their books. All at the nation's largest book fair, 29th Miami Book Fair International, November 11 through 18. Information at miamibookfair.com. The Kingmaker's Daughter is just out from the popular Philippa Gregory, and it's already climbing its way up the Times bestseller list. It's a gripping and ultimately tragic story of the daughters of the man known as the Kingmaker, the Earl of Warwick, one of England's most powerful men in the Cousins' War of the 1400s. In the absence of a son and heir, Warwick uses his two girls, Anne and Isabel, as pawns in his political games. At the court of Edward IV, Anne enjoyed a delightful childhood, brought up in intimacy and friendship with the family of Richard, Duke of Gloucester. But her situation changed drastically when her father began to make war on his former friends. Anne's will is tested when she is left widowed and fatherless, with her mother in sanctuary and her sister married to the enemy. Fortune's wheel turns again when Richard rescues Anne from her sister's house. But danger follows her, even as she ascends to the throne as queen. Having lost those closest to her, she must protect herself and her only child, Prince Edward, from a court full of royal rivals. To quote Publishers Weekly, in addition to Gregory handling a complicated history, she convincingly details women's lives in the 1400s and the competitive love between sisters. Bianca Amato performs the work.
Nobody likes this queen. I shouldn't admire her. It shouldn't matter to us that she smiles warmly at Isabel and me, that she rises from her great chair to come forwards and clasp my mother's hands. We're all determined not to like her. My father had a good marriage planned for this king, a great match, a princess of France. My father worked at this, prepared the ground, drafted the marriage contract, persuaded people who hate the French that this would be a good thing for the country, would safeguard Calais, might even get Bordeaux back into our keeping. But then Edward, the new king, the heart-stoppingly handsome and glamorous new king, our darling Edward, like a younger brother to my father and a glorious uncle to us, said as simply as if he were ordering his dinner that he was married already and nothing could be done about it. Married already? Yes. And to her. He did very wrong to act without my father's advice. Everyone knows that. It is the first time he has done so in the long, triumphant campaign that took the House of York from shame when they had to beg the forgiveness of the sleeping king and the bad queen to victory and the throne of England. My father has been at Edward's side, advising and guiding him, dictating his every move. My father has always judged what is best for him. The king, even though he is king now, is a young man who owes my father everything. He would not have his throne if it were not for my father taking up his cause, teaching him how to lead an army, fighting his battles for him. My father risked his own life, first for Edward's father, and then for Edward himself. And then, just when the sleeping king and the bad queen had run away, and Edward was crowned king, and everything should have been wonderful forever, he went off and secretly married her. She is to lead us into dinner, and the ladies arrange themselves carefully behind her. There's a set order, and it is extremely important that you make sure to be in the right place. I am very nearly 9 years old, quite old enough to understand this, and I have been taught the orders of precedence since I was a little girl in the schoolroom. Since she is to be crowned tomorrow, she goes first. From now on, she will always be first in England. She will walk in front of my mother for the rest of her life, and that's another thing my mother doesn't much like. Next should come the king's mother, but she is not here. She's declared her absolute enmity to the beautiful Elizabeth Woodville, and sworn that she will not witness the coronation of a commoner. Everyone knows of this rift in the royal family, and the king's sisters fall into line without the supervision of their mother. They look quite lost without the beautiful Duchess Cecily leading the way. And the king loses his confident smile for just a moment when he sees the space where his mother should be. I don't know how he dares to go against the Duchess. She's just as terrifying as my mother. She's my father's aunt, and nobody disobeys either of them. All I can think is that the king must be very much in love with the new queen to defy his mother. He must really, really love her. The queen's mother is here, though. No chance that she would miss such a moment of triumph. She steps into her place with her army of sons and daughters behind her, her handsome husband, Sir Richard Woodville, at her side. He is Baron Rivers, and everyone whispers the joke that the rivers are rising. Truly, there are an unbelievable number of them. Elizabeth is the oldest daughter, and behind her mother come the seven sisters and five brothers. I stare at the handsome young man, John Woodville, beside his new wife, looking like a boy escorting his grandmother. He has been bundled into marriage with the Dowager Duchess of Norfolk, my great-aunt, Catherine Neville. This is an outrage. My father himself says so. My lady great-aunt Catherine is ancient, a priceless ruin, nearly 70 years old. Few people have ever seen a living woman so old. And John Woodville is a young man of 20.
That was The Kingmaker's Daughter by Philippa Gregory. Ken Follett is one of the world's most popular novelists. His books, among which I know you've read several, have sold more than 130 million copies around the globe. Follett burst into the book world in 1978 with Eye of the Needle, a taut original thriller which won the Edgar Award and, like many of his books to follow, became a major Hollywood film. Popular novels were next, including Triple, The Key to Rebecca, The Man from St. Petersburg, and Lie Down with Lions. Follett then surprised readers by radically changing course with The Pillars of the Earth, a novel about building a cathedral in the Middle Ages. Published in September 1989, it was on the Times bestseller list for 18 weeks. His current project is perhaps his most ambitious to date. The Century Trilogy will tell the entire history of the 20th century, seen through the eyes of five linked families, one American, one English, one German, one Russian, and one Welsh. The first book, The Fall of Giants, focused on World War I and the Russian Revolution, and it was published in September 2010. The second book, Winter of the World, chronicles the Second World War, and it will be our topic of discussion today. Welcome, Ken. Thanks so much for taking time from Book Tour to speak with us today.
It's great to be on the show.
What made you decide to take on a project as sweeping in scope as the Century Trilogy?
Well, you know, when I'm thinking about what to write, I always think I've got to give people something they can't get on television. And, you know, television drama is exciting and it's well written and it's very easy to turn on the TV. And I want people to turn off the TV and pick up a book. So I've got to give them something that they think is going to be better than what they can see on TV. So that's why more and more these days I'm writing long books that, as well as being dramatic, I hope, dramatic and exciting and full of interesting characters, also enable you to learn something and to better understand the history and where you came from.
Well, I have a master's in history, and I thought your book was fascinating, intriguing, and captivating.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Had you planned or outlined the entire trilogy before you began writing book one?
I did block it out, yes. I spent the first 6 months of this project reading the history of the 20th century overall and blocking out the three books in the trilogy. And then after 6 months doing that, I focused on the first book, Fall of Giants, and started to outline that in more detail. But I did, yes, I did try right at the start to get a big picture of the story of the 20th century.
And with a story so big, did you set a timeline of completion for each book for yourself and then actually stick to it?
Yes, well, I did set a timetable, and I've stuck to it so far. I'm touching wood here. But, so I took 3 years to do Fall of Giants, but I've completed Winter of the World in 2 years, and I'm hoping to complete the third book in the trilogy, which would be called Edge of Eternity. I'm hoping to complete that in 2 years so that I'll be able to publish it 2 years from now. Wish me luck, okay?
I will. You tell the tale through the story of five intertwined families, and that's it immediately draws you in. How did you craft that idea?
Well, I began with the history, but then I thought, okay, these are the great momentous events that are going to happen during the course of these novels. Now, who will be the people who will live through these and take part in these events and whose lives will be transformed by these events? And so I wanted to pick characters who could be present at more than one great event. So I have characters who move, for example, from St. Petersburg to the United States, and from the United States to London, and it was really a question of having a small number of people who could live through a great many momentous events.
I have to ask you, as the writer and kind of the father of this story, did you have a favorite character or storyline that you just, you know, loved writing more than maybe some of the others?
Well, in the first book, Fall of Giants, I was interested particularly in the Welsh coal mining family because I come from a family of Welsh coal miners. My grandfather did what Billy does in right at the beginning of Fall of Giants. At the age of 13, he went down the pit, as they say, which means he started work as a coal miner. So when I was telling that story, I was to some extent repeating stories that I was told as a child about my own family. So I was, in the first book, I was particularly fond of that aspect of the story. The person I like in Winter of the World probably is Daisy. She's not very wise, particularly at the beginning. She makes a lot of terrible mistakes, but she learns from her mistakes very quickly, and she becomes, in the end, a much nicer person than she was at the start. And she's also pretty and sexy, so what's not to like?
Exactly. Very pretty and very kind of calculating at the beginning. When a location is so central to the story and you have to depict it so intricately, do you actually make it a point to visit most of the places that you write about?
Yes, I do. I much prefer to have actually walked around these places myself. Of course, many of the great cities in Winter of the World are places that are already familiar to me. London, Washington, Berlin, Moscow and St. Petersburg, Paris. These are all places that are familiar to me. But it's useful, if I haven't been to a place, it's useful to go. For example, in Winter of the World, I went to do research in the central Spanish desert, and I went to a town called Belchite, which was the site of a famous battle in the Spanish Civil War. And in Winter of the World, several of the characters in Winter of the World are present at this battle, and they live through it, and they fight through it, and some of them die. And it was quite important to me and very useful to me to be able to go there. This town was destroyed in the battle, but The ruins are still there. And I was able to walk around the ruins of this town, walk down the streets where they fought, see the church where the rebels were holed up. And it made it easier for me to vividly imagine the battle. That kind of thing I do find helpful.
Winter of the World, as we know, is the second in the trilogy, yet it's a book readers can pick up without having read book one, The Fall of Giants. How were you able to achieve that?
Well, I think it would be, you know, it would be fun to read Fall of Giants and then Winter of the World, but it would be just as much fun, I think, to read Winter of the World and then say, oh, okay, what happened to the parents of these characters and what was their story, and then go back to Fall of Giants. And I think my aim was to make sure that Winter of the World had a beginning and a middle and an end that you could pick up on and read through without having to ask yourself questions about what happened 20 years earlier.
I have to ask, when you're planning a project that is so massive in scope, is it really daunting? I mean, or you just sit down and write every day?
Well, both. Yes, I just sit down and write every day, but yes, I was daunted by the Century Trilogy when I began. And, you know, a question on my mind is, am I capable of doing this? You're quite right, Elaine. It is very ambitious to try and tell the history of the 20th century in the form of a trilogy of novels. And, you know, I was thinking to myself, okay, it's a great idea if it works, but will I be able to do it? So, yet daunting is a very good word for it, but happily readers really liked Fall of Giants, so that made me feel that I was able to do it. And I have my fingers crossed that they will like Winter of the World just as much.
Yeah. Now, I know you're already working on book three, but is there a standalone project that perhaps you're formulating in your mind already?
You mean for afterwards?
Yes,
no.
Yes.
No, it's as much as I can do to keep one novel in my head at a time, you know, and I sometimes slip and I get people's ages wrong or I get the color of their eyes wrong. And if I tried to think about the book after this one too much, then I would become I'd become very confused. So no, I really very much focus on one book at a time.
All right. Audiobook listeners loved John Lee's performance of book one. Will he be back in book two, and are you involved with the audio productions at all?
No, I don't get involved in that. It's a complicated business, and I leave it to the experts. Some writers read their own books for the audio book, and I'm occasionally asked why I don't do that. And, of course, I could do it, but actors do it so much better.
Yeah.
And it's a great thrill to me to have really good people read my book. And, you know, and the actors can do, they do the dialogue in different voices and different accents, and they bring a sense of drama to the audio book that is, you know, it's their talent. And I respect that, and I love that they do such a good job for me. And the last thing I want to do is to step in and say, I think I'll do this myself.
I think after listening to so many audiobooks, you are a very wise man indeed. Well, readers, this is one book you will want to pick up, and I doubt that you'll be able to put it down until you finish it. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ken.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Alrighty, bye.
Now, let's listen to book one of the Century Trilogy, The Fall of Giants. The book tracks the fates of the five interrelated families as they move through the world-shaking dramas of the First World War, the Russian Revolution, and the struggle for women's suffrage. John Lee narrates.
Most of the ground floor was taken up by the living room, 15 feet square, with a table in the middle and a fireplace to one side, and a homemade rug on the stone floor. Dar was sitting at the table reading an old copy of the Daily Mail, a pair of spectacles perched on the bridge of his long, sharp nose. Mam was making tea. She put down the steaming kettle, kissed Billy's forehead, and said, "How's my little man on his birthday?" Billy did not reply. The little was wounding, because he was little, and the man was just as hurtful, because he was not a man. He went into the scullery at the back of the house. He dipped a tin bowl into the water barrel, washed his face and hands, and poured the water away in the shallow stone sink. The scullery had a copper with a fire grate underneath, but it was used only on bath night, which was Saturday. They had been promised running water soon, and some of the miners' houses already had it. It seemed a miracle to Billy that people could get a cup of cold, clear water just by turning the tap, and not have to carry a bucket to the standpipe out in the street. But indoor water had not yet come to Wellington Row, where the Williamses lived. He returned to the living room and sat at the table. Mam put a big cup of milky tea in front of him, already sugared. She cut two thick slices off a loaf of homemade bread and got a slab of dripping from the pantry under the stairs. Billy put his hands together, closed his eyes, and said, "Thank you, Lord, for this food. Amen." Then he drank some tea and spread dripping on his bread. Dar's pale blue eyes looked over the top of the paper. "Put salt on your bread," he said. "You'll sweat underground." Billy's father was a miner's agent, employed by the South Wales Miners' Federation, which was the strongest trade union in Britain, as he said whenever he got the chance. He was known as Dai Union. A lot of men were called Dai, pronounced Dai, short for David, or Dafydd in Welsh. Billy had learned in school that David was popular in Wales because it was the name of the country's patron saint, like Patrick in Ireland. All the Dais were distinguished one from another not by their surnames. Almost everyone in town was Jones, Williams, Evans, or Morgan, but by a nickname. Real names were rarely used when there was a humorous alternative. Billy was William Williams, so they called him Billy twice. Women were sometimes given their husband's nickname, so that Mam was Mrs. Dai Union. Grandpa came down while Billy was eating his second slice. Despite the warm weather, he wore a jacket and waistcoat. When he had washed his hands, he sat opposite Billy. "Don't look so nervous," he said. "I went down the pit when I was 10, and my father was carried to the pit on his father's back at the age of 5, and worked from 6 in the morning until 7 in the evening. He never saw daylight from October to March." "I'm not nervous," Billy said. This was untrue. He was scared stiff. However, Grandpa was kindly, and he did not press the point. Billy liked Grandpa. Mam treated Billy like a baby, and Dar was stern and sarcastic, but Grandpa was tolerant and talked to Billy as to an adult. "Listen to this," said Dar. He would never buy the Mail, a right-wing rag, but he sometimes brought home someone else's copy and read the paper aloud in a scornful voice, mocking the stupidity and dishonesty of the ruling class. "Lady Diana Manners has been criticised for wearing the same dress to two different balls. The younger daughter of the Duke of Rutland won Best Lady's Costume at the Savoy Ball for her off-the-shoulder boned bodice with full hooped skirt, receiving a prize of 250 guineas. He lowered the paper and said, "That's at least 5 years' wages for you, Billy boy." He resumed. "But she drew the frowns of the cognoscenti by wearing the same dress to Lord Winterton and F. E. Smith's party at Claridge's Hotel. One can have too much of a good thing, people said." He looked up from the paper. "You'd better change that frock, ma'am," he said. "You don't want to draw the frowns of the cognoscenti." Ma'am was not amused.
We've just heard Fall of Giants, Book One in the Century Trilogy by Ken Follett. The Book Report found this gem on the Times bestseller list for nonfiction. Double Cross, The True Story of the D-Day Spies by Ben McIntyre, chronicles one of history's most sophisticated and successful deception operations. On June 6, 1944, 150,000 Allied troops landed on the beaches at Normandy. The casualty rate was astonishingly low. D-Day was a stunning military accomplishment and a masterpiece of trickery.
Operation Fortitude, which protected and enabled the invasion, and the Double Cross system, which specialized in turning German spies into double agents, deceived the Nazis into believing that the Allies would attack at Calais and Norway rather than Normandy. It was the key to saving thousands of lives and securing an Allied victory at the most critical junction in the war. The story of D-Day has been told from the point of view of the soldiers who fought in it, the tacticians who planned it, and the generals who led it. But the epic event has never before been told from the perspective of the individuals in the Double Cross system, its director, a colorful assortment of MI5 handlers, and the five spies who formed the Double Cross nucleus, including a Serbian playboy, a Polish fighter pilot, and a bisexual Peruvian party girl. The D-Day spies were, without question, one of the oddest military units ever assembled. I think you're going to be fascinated by this one. John Lee narrates.
Dushko and Johnny were friends. Their friendship was founded on a shared appreciation of money, cars, parties, and women, in no particular order, and preferably all at the same time. Their relationship, based almost entirely on frivolity, would have a profound impact on world history. Dusan Dushko Popov and Johann Johnny Jebsen met in 1936 at the University of Freiburg in southern Germany. Popov, the son of a wealthy Serbian industrialist from Dubrovnik, was 25. Jebsen, the heir to a large shipping company, was 19. Both were spoiled, charming, and feckless. Popov drove a BMW. Jebsen, a supercharged Mercedes 540K convertible. This inseparable pair of international playboys roistered around Freiburg, behaving badly. Popov was a law student, while Jebsen was taking an economics degree, the better to manage the family firm. Neither did any studying at all. "We both had some intellectual pretensions," wrote Popov, "but we were addicted to sports cars and sporting girls and had enough money to keep them both running." Popov had a round, open face, with hair brushed back from a high forehead. Opinion was divided on his looks. "He smiles freely, showing all his teeth, and in repose his face is not unpleasant, though certainly not handsome," wrote one male contemporary. "He had a well-flattened, typically Slav nose, complexion sallow, broad shoulders, athletic carriage, but rather podgy, white, and well-kept hands, which he waved in wild gesticulation. Women frequently found him irresistible, with his easy manners, loose, sensual mouth, and green eyes behind heavy lids. He had what were then known as bedroom eyes. Indeed, the bedroom was his main focus of interest. Popov was an unstoppable womanizer. Jebsen cut a rather different figure. He was slight and thin, with dark blonde hair, high cheekbones, and a turned-up nose. Where Popov was noisily gregarious, Jebsen was watchful. His coldness, aloofness, could be forbidding, yet everyone was under his spell, Popov wrote. He had much warmth, too, and his intelligence was reflected in his face, in the alertness of his steel-blue eyes. He spoke abruptly, in short phrases, hardly ever used an adjective, and was, above all, ironic. Jebsen walked with a limp, and hinted that this was from an injury sustained in some wild escapade. In truth, it was caused by the pain of varicose veins, to which he was a secret martyr. He loved to spin a story, to deliberately stir up situations to see what would happen. But he also liked to broker deals. When Popov was challenged to a sword duel over a girl, it was Jebsen, as his second, who quietly arranged a peaceful solution, to Popov's relief, not thinking my looks would be improved by a bright red cicatrix. Jebsen's parents, both dead by the time he arrived in Freiburg, had been born in Denmark, but adopted German citizenship when the shipping firm, Jebsen and Jebsen, moved to Hamburg. Jebsen was born in that city in 1917, but liked to joke that he was really Danish, his German citizenship being a flag of convenience for business purposes. "Some of my love of my country has to do with so much of it actually belonging to me," A rich, rootless orphan, Jepsen had visited Britain as a teenager and returned a committed Anglophile. He affected English manners, spoke English in preference to German, and dressed, he thought, like a young Anthony Eden, conservatively elegant. Popoff remarked he would no more go without an umbrella than without his trousers. Preoccupied as they were with having fun, the two student friends could not entirely ignore the menacing political changes taking place around them in the Germany of the 1930s. They made a point of teasing the pro-Nazi student intelligentsia. The mockery, however, had a metal strand to it. Under that mask of a snob and cynic, and under his playboy manners, Jepsen was developing a deep distaste for Nazism. Popoff found the posturing Nazi brown shirts ridiculous and repulsive.
We've just heard a sampling of Double Cross, the true story of the D-Day spies by Ben McIntyre. More espionage, but this time on U.S. soil. December 7th, 1941. Americans have long debated the cause of the Pearl Harbor bombing. Many argue the attack was a brilliant Japanese military coup, or a failure of U.S. intelligence, or even a conspiracy of the Roosevelt administration. Despite the attention historians have paid to the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the truth about that fateful day has remained a mystery. In Operation Snow, how a Soviet mole in FDR's White House triggered Pearl Harbor, John Koster, a journalist, Army vet, and World War II expert, uses recently declassified evidence and never-before-translated documents to tell the story of the tragic day. The book shows how Joseph Stalin and the KGB used a vast network of double agents and communist sympathizers, most notably Harry Dexter White, to lead Japan into the war against the U.S. Admiral Ronald Hayes, former commander-in-chief of the Pacific Forces, commented, quote, "I found Operation Snow to be irresistible. The attack exacted a terrible toll on both countries and changed the world forever. It is important to understand why that happened. Koster has made a significant contribution," end quote. Michael Kramer narrates.
Vitaly Pavlov groped through his pocket and finally came up with two quarters and a dime. He was nervous. At 27, Pavlov was the second in command of Soviet espionage operations for the NKVD in the United States, following a purge in which Joseph Stalin had murdered many of the senior agents. Successor to the Cheka and predecessor of the KGB, which replaced it in 1946, the NKVD was a murderous agency with its own foreign policy. Pavlov had arrived in the United States a month earlier, in April 1941, and was still fumbling through a new world of cultural confusion. Blonde, handsome, self-conscious about his shaky command of English, and in over his head in the lethal world of espionage, Pavlov was on a mission of importance far beyond his years or experience. Pavlov slid into a phone booth in Washington, D.C. and shut the door. He inserted the coins into the unfamiliar telephone, heard the clink and jangle, and dialed. The phone started to ring. He said later that he felt time had stopped. Someone picked up at the other end. "White here," the voice said.
"Mr. White, I'm a friend of your old friend Bill," Pavlov said. "Bill is in the Far East and wants to meet with you when he comes back. He wants you to meet with me right now."
Harry Dexter White was the director of the Division of Monetary Research of the U.S. Treasury Department. Bill was Ichak Abdulovich Akhmerov, a Russified Tatar NKVD agent, posing as an expert on China whom White had met 2 years earlier on the recommendation of Joseph Katz, yet another NKVD agent and active first-line spy recruiter. Katz was co-owner of a New York City glove manufacturing company which operated as a cover. Akhmerov, a Bolshevik since his teens in 1919, with dark hair, narrow eyes, and a square classic profile, was handsome in a Hollywood tough-guy way that women found fascinating. Katz, who wore alarmingly thick eyeglasses, full dentures, and walked with a limp, spoke German, Lithuanian, Russian, and Yiddish. He was a superb middleman in the world of espionage because he looked nothing like a spy. "I have a pretty busy schedule," White said nervously. Pavlov was ready for this. NKVD sources had described Wyatt as a dedicated communist sympathizer and a source of information since the mid-1930s, but also as timid and rather cowardly. "I'm only going to be in Washington for a few days, and it's important to Bill that you meet with me," Pavlov said. "If you can give me half an hour at Old Ebbitt Grill, I'll pay for the lunch." "How will I know who you are?" White asked. "I'll try to get to restaurant a few minutes before you do," Pavlov said, sensing agreement. "I'm of average height, blonde hair, and I'll be carrying a copy of New Yorker, and leave it on table." "All right," White said reluctantly. Pavlov had breakfast the next day with his handler, an NKVD agent known as Michael, and went over the details as they rode to the Old Ebbitt Grill in a Soviet embassy limousine. Michael reminded him that White was a senior official of the United States government, and that Pavlov should not make any offer that included outright treason, for fear of entrapment and the notoriety that entrapment might bring. Michael reminded Pavlov that he was protected by a diplomatic courier's passport, and even if White refused to help and turned him into the FBI, Pavlov himself would be safe, though with the tacit understanding that Comrade Stalin did not like people to fail. Michael probably knew, even if Pavlov did not, that Rudolf Hess, Hitler's most devoted follower and the top Nazi fluent in English, had flown to a meeting with British aristocrats on May 10th to make an astounding offer. Britain, then apparently losing the war with the Hitler-Stalin alliance, could have peace with Germany if Britain agreed to stay neutral in the coming clash between Germany and Russia. Hitler offered to evacuate France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Norway, and Denmark, keeping only German-speaking Luxembourg and Alsace-Lorraine, if Winston Churchill stepped down as Prime Minister and Britain gave Germany a free hand in Eastern Europe.
That was Operation Snow, How a Soviet Mole in FDR's White House Triggered Pearl Harbor, by John Koster. Come to Miami for the warm winter weather and for the 29th Miami Book Fair International, where Tom Wolfe, Juno Diaz, Lemony Snicket, Sandra Cisneros, and more than 300 authors from around the world will read from their books, answer questions, and autograph their books. All at the nation's largest book fair, 29th Miami Book Fair International, November 11 through 18. Information at miamibookfair.com.
Readers, I was just visiting that toddlin' town, Chicago. Upon recommendations from several friends, I took an architectural boat tour. What a great way to spend a few hours in the Windy City. The guide referred constantly to architect Daniel Burnham and Eric Larson's book, The Devil in the White City. I bought the book as soon as the boat docked. Of course, Larson is the author of the much acclaimed In the Garden of Beasts. We previewed that book last year, and you'll find it on bookreportradio.com, week of June 25th, 2011. The book we're previewing today recounts the spellbinding tale of the 1893 World's Fair, the World's Columbian Exposition. The White City, as it became known, was a magical creation constructed by Daniel Burnham, who coordinated the talents of famous colleagues like Frederick Olmsted and Louis Sullivan. As a parallel storyline, an evil doctor, Henry Holmes, was operating in Chicago at the same time, luring scores of women to their deaths. Whereas the fair marked the birth of a new epoch in American history, Holmes marked the emergence of a new American archetype, the serial killer, who thrived on the very forces then transforming the country. Scott Brick narrates.
He recognized that the systemic malaise that caused it was a consequence, in part, of his own refusal over the years to limit his courtship of the finest wines, foods, and cigars. The pain reminded him daily that his time on the planet was nearing an end. Just before the voyage, he told a friend, "This prolonging of a man's life doesn't interest me when he's done his work and has done it pretty well." The man was Daniel Hudson Burnham, and by now his name was familiar throughout the world. He was an architect and had done his work pretty well in Chicago, New York, Washington, San Francisco, Manila, and many other cities. He and his wife Margaret were sailing to Europe in the company of their daughter and her husband for a grand tour that was to continue through the summer. Burnham had chosen this ship, the RMS Olympic of the White Star Line, because it was new and glamorous and big. At the time he booked passage, the Olympic was the largest vessel in regular service, but just 2 days before his departure, a sister ship, a slightly longer twin, had stolen that rank when it set off on its maiden voyage. The twin, Burnham knew, was at that moment carrying one of his closest friends, the painter Francis Millet, over the same ocean, but in the opposite direction. As the last sunlight of the day entered Burnham's suite, he and Margaret set off for the first-class dining room on the deck below. They took the elevator to spare his foot the torment of the grand stairway, but he did so with reluctance, for he admired the artistry of the iron scrollwork of its balustrades and the immense dome of iron and glass that flushed the ship's core with natural light. His sore foot had placed increasing limitations on his mobility. Only a week earlier he had found himself in the humiliating position of having to ride in a wheelchair through Union Station in Washington, D.C., the station he had designed. The Burnhams dined by themselves in the Olympic's first-class salon, then retired to their suite, and there, for no particular reason, Burnham's thoughts returned to Frank Millet. On impulse, he resolved to send Millet a mid-sea greeting via the Olympic's powerful Marconi wireless. Burnham signaled for a steward. A middle-aged man in knife-edge whites took his message up 3 decks to the Marconi room adjacent to the officer's promenade. He returned a few moments later, the message still in his hand, and told Burnham the operator had refused to accept it. Footsore and irritable, Burnham demanded that the steward return to the wireless room for an explanation. Millet was never far from Burnham's mind, nor was the event that had brought the two of them together. The great Chicago World's Fair of 1893. Millet had been one of Burnham's closest allies in the long, bittersweet struggle to build the fair. Its official name was the World's Columbian Exposition, its official purpose to commemorate the 400th anniversary of Columbus's discovery of America. But under Burnham, its chief builder, it had become something enchanting, known throughout the world as the White City. It had lasted just 6 months, yet during that time its gatekeepers recorded 27.5 million visits, this when the country's total population was 65 million. On its best day, the fair drew over 700,000 visitors. That the fair had occurred at all, however, was something of a miracle. To build it, Burnham confronted a legion of obstacles, any one of which could have, should have, killed it long before opening day. Together, he and his architects conjured a dream city whose grandeur and beauty exceeded anything each singly could have imagined. Visitors wore their best clothes and most somber expressions, as if entering a great cathedral. Some wept at its beauty. They tasted a new snack called Cracker Jack and a new breakfast food called shredded wheat. Whole villages had been imported from Egypt, Algeria, Dahomey, and other far-flung locales, along with their inhabitants. The streets of Cairo exhibit alone employed nearly 200 Egyptians and contained 25 distinct buildings, including a 1,500-seat theater that introduced America to a new and scandalous form of entertainment. Everything about the fair was exotic and, above all, immense. The fair occupied more than 1 square mile and filled over 200 buildings. A single exhibit hall was large enough to have housed the U.S. Capitol, the Great Pyramid, Winchester Cathedral, Madison Square Garden, and St. Paul's Cathedral all at the same time. One structure, rejected first as a monstrosity, became the fair's emblem, a machine so huge and terrifying it instantly eclipsed the tower of Alexander Eiffel that had so wounded America's pride. Never before had so many of history's brightest lights, including Buffalo Bill, Theodore Dreiser, Susan B. Anthony, Jane Addams, Clarence Darrow, George Westinghouse, Thomas Edison, Henry Adams, Archduke Francis Ferdinand, Nikola Tesla, Ignace Paderewski, Philip Armour, Marshall Field, gathered in one place at one time. Richard Harding Davis called the exposition the greatest event in the history of the country since the Civil War.
That was The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson. No Easy Day, the firsthand account of the mission that killed Osama bin Laden by Mark Owen and Kevin Maurer, is the first-person account of the planning and execution of the bin Laden raid from a Navy SEAL who confronted the terrorist and witnessed his final moments. From the mountaintops of Afghanistan to the third floor of Osama bin Laden's compound, Mark Owen of the U.S. Naval Special Warfare Development Group, or SEAL Team 6, has been a part of some of the most memorable special operations in history, as well as missions that never made it to the headlines. No Easy Day puts listeners alongside Owen and the other members of the 24-man team as they trained for the biggest mission of their lives. The blow-by-blow narrative of the assault, beginning with the helicopter crash that could have ended Owen's life, straight through to the radio call confirming bin Laden's death, is an essential piece of modern history. Owen's story draws on his youth in Alaska and describes the SEALs' quest to challenge themselves at the highest level of physical and mental endurance. With boots-on-the-ground detail, Owen describes numerous previously unreported missions that illustrate the life and work of a SEAL and the evolution of the team after the events of September 11th. Holter Graham narrates.
In an effort to protect the nature of specific operations, I sometimes generalize dates, times, and order of events. None of these workarounds affect the accuracy of my recollections or my description of how events unfolded. The operations discussed in this book have been written about in numerous other civilian and government publications and are available in open sources to the general public. The events depicted in No Easy Day are based on my own memory. Conversations have been reconstructed from my recollections. War is chaotic, but I've done my best to ensure that the stories in this book are accurate. If there are inaccuracies in it, the responsibility is mine. This book presents my views and does not represent the views of the United States Navy, the U.S. Department of Defense, or anyone else. In spite of the deliberate measures I have undertaken to protect the national security of the United States and the operational security of the men and women who continue to fight around the world, I believe No Easy Day to be an accurate portrayal of the events it describes and an honest portrayal of life in the SEAL teams and the brotherhood that exists among us. While written in the first person, my experiences are universal, and I'm no better or worse than any man I've served with. It was a long, hard decision to write this book, and some in the community will look down on me for doing so. However, it is time to set the record straight about one of the most important missions in U.S. military history. Lost in the media coverage of the bin Laden raid is why and how the mission was successful. This book will finally give credit to those who earned it. The mission was a team effort, from the intelligence analysts who found Osama bin Laden to the helicopter pilots who flew us to Abbottabad to the men who assaulted the compound. No one man or woman was more important than another. No Easy Day is the story of the guys, the human toll we pay, and the sacrifices we make to do this dirty job. This book is about a brotherhood that existed long before I joined and that will be around long after I'm gone. My hope is one day a young man in junior high school will read it and become a SEAL, or at least live a life bigger than him. If that happens, this book is a success. Mark Owen, June 22, 2012, Virginia Beach, Virginia. Prologue. Chalk one. At 1 minute out, the Blackhawk crew chief slid the door open. I could just make him out, his night vision goggles covering his eyes, holding up one finger. I glanced around and saw my SEAL teammates calmly passing the sign throughout the helicopter. The roar of the engine filled the cabin, and it was now impossible to hear anything other than the Blackhawk's rotors beating the air. The wind buffeted me as I leaned out, scanning the ground below, hoping to steal a glance of the city of Abbottabad. An hour and a half before, we'd boarded our two MH-60 Blackhawks and lifted off into a moonless night. It was only a short flight from our base in Jalalabad, Afghanistan, to the border with Pakistan, and from there another hour to the target we had been studying on satellite images for weeks. The cabin was pitch black, except for the lights from the cockpit. I had been wedged against the left door with no room to stretch out. We'd stripped the helicopter of its seats to save on weight, so we either sat on the floor or on small camp chairs purchased at a local sporting goods store before we left. Now perched on the edge of the cabin, I stretched my legs out the door, trying to get the blood flowing. My legs were numb and cramped. Crowded into the cabin around me and in the second helicopter were 23 of my teammates from the Naval Special Warfare Development Group, or DEVGRU. I had operated with these men dozens of times before, some I had known 10 years or more. I trusted each one completely. 5 minutes ago, the whole cabin had come alive. We pulled on our helmets and checked our radios and then made one final check of our weapons. I was wearing 60 pounds of gear, each gram meticulously chosen for a specific purpose, my load refined and calibrated over a dozen years and hundreds of similar missions.
We have just heard No Easy Day, the firsthand account of the mission that killed Osama bin Laden by Mark Owen and Kevin Maurer. Mid-century Los Angeles, a land of sunshine and orange groves, wholesome Midwestern values, and Hollywood stars, protected by the world's most famous police force. Behind this image lies a hidden world of pleasure girls and crooked cops, ruthless newspaper tycoons, corrupt politicians, and East Coast gangsters on the make. Into this underworld come two men. One, LA's most notorious gangster. The other, its most famous police chief. Each prepared to battle the other for the soul of the city. John Bunton's LA Noir, The Struggle for the Soul of America's Most Seductive City, tells the tale of former street thug turned featherweight boxer Mickey Cohen. Cohen left the ring for the rackets, first as mobster Bugsy Siegel's enforcer, then as his protege. A fastidious dresser and unrepentant killer, Cohen was Hollywood's favorite gangster and LA's preeminent underworld boss. Frank Sinatra, Robert Mitchum, and Sammy Davis Jr. palled around with him. TV journalist Mike Wallace wanted his stories. Evangelist Billy Graham sought his soul. William H. Parker was the proud son of a pioneering law enforcement family from the fabled frontier town of Deadwood. As a rookie patrolman in the Roaring Twenties, he discovered L.A. was ruled by a triumvirate of tycoons, politicians, and underworld figures. Parker's life mission became to topple it and to create a police force that would never answer to elected officials again. These two men, one morally unflinching, the other unflinchingly immoral, would soon come head-to-head in a struggle to control the city. A struggle that echoes unforgettably through the fiction of Raymond Chandler and movies like The Big Sleep, Chinatown, and L.A. Confidential. From Prohibition through the Watts riots, the battle between the underworld and the police played out amid the nightclubs of Sunset Strip and the mansions of Beverly Hills and intersected with the agendas and ambitions of J. Edgar Hoover, Robert F. Kennedy, and Malcolm X. The outcome of this decades-long entanglement shaped modern American policing, for better and for worse, and helped create the Los Angeles we know today. Kirby Hayborn narrates.
Mickey Cohen was not a man used to being shaken down. Threatened with handguns, blasted with shotguns, strafed on occasion by a machine gun, yes. firebombed and dynamited? Sure. But threatened, extorted, hit up for $20,000? No. Anyone who read the tabloids in post-World War II Los Angeles knew that extortion was Mickey's racket, along with bookmaking, gambling, loan sharking, slot machines, narcotics, union agitation, and a substantial portion of the city's other illicit pastimes. In the years following Benjamin Bugsy Siegel's ill-fated move to Las Vegas, Mickey Cohen had become the top mobster on the West Coast, and the tart-tongued, sharp-dressed, pint-sized gangster, whom the more circumspect newspapers described tactfully as a prominent figure in the sporting life world, hadn't gotten there by being easily intimidated, certainly not by mid-level police functionaries. Yet in October 1948, that is precisely what the head of the Los Angeles Police Department Vice Squad set out to do. Cohen was no stranger to the heat. During his first days in Los Angeles as Bugsy Siegel's enforcer, he had been instructed to squeeze Eddie Neals, the proprietor of the Clover Club. Located on the Sunset Strip, an unincorporated county area just outside of Los Angeles city limits, the Clover Club was Southern California's poshest gaming joint. It reputedly paid the LA County Sheriff's Department a small fortune for protection. The squad that provided it, led by Detective George Ironman Contreras, had a formidable reputation. People who crossed it died. According to Cohen, one member of the unit had been the trigger man on 11 killings. So when Neal sicked Contreras' men on Cohen, he undoubtedly expected that the sheriff's men would scare Mickey stiff. Contreras tried. Cohen was picked up and brought in to receive a warning. If he didn't lay off Neal's, the next warning would come in the form of a bullet to the head. Mickey wasn't impressed. A few nights later, he sought out Contreras's top gunman. I looked him up and said to him, "Let me tell you something. To me, you're no cop. Being no cop, I got a right to kill you. So come prepared. The next time I see you coming to me, I'm going to hit you between the eyes." It was an effective warning. "He felt I was sincere," Mickey later reported. The cops backed down. Until now. The fact of the matter was, Mickey Cohen was in an uncharacteristically vulnerable position that fall. 2 months earlier, on Wednesday, August 18th, as Cohen was putting the final touches on his newest venture, a swank men's clothing shop on Sunset Boulevard named Michael's Haberdashery, three gunmen had charged into the store and opened fire, wounding two Cohen henchmen and killing his top gunman, Hooky Rothman. Mickey himself was in the back bathroom washing his hands, something the obsessive-compulsive gangster did 50 or 60 times a day. Trapped, he hid in a stall, atop a toilet, awaiting his death. But instead of checking to see that they'd gotten their man, item number one on the professional hitman's checklist, the gunman fled. A few minutes later, the incredulous driver of the gunman's crash car saw Mickey scurry to safety out the front door. Cohen had survived, but great damage had been done. As Siegel shifted his attention to Las Vegas, Mickey had taken over his old boss's Los Angeles operations, as well as Siegel's organized crime connections back east. The attempted hit on Cohen not only showed that Mickey was vulnerable, it suggested that Bugsy's powerful friends had no particular commitment to his protege's survival. In short, Mickey looked weak. And in the underworld, weakness attracts predators.
That was L.A. Noir by John Bunton. Readers, you think you know a story, and then new historical evidence comes out to shed new light and perspective on events. Fascinating stuff, and why we keep reading. For more books worth your time and attention, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining us today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.